tone. What acid wit! A truly great message altogether. It sounded nearly human. I was very proud. I breathed in again, listening to the melodic beep that followed. "Hi, it's me." A female voice, not Deborah. I felt one eyelid twitch in irritation. Why do so many people start their messages with, "It's me"? Of course it is you. We all know that. But who the hell are you? In my case, the choices were rather limited. I knew it wasn't Deborah. It didn't sound like Lagerta, although anything was possible, so that left... Rita? I'm sorry, I... A long breath, sighing out. Listen, Dexter, I'm sorry. I thought you would call me, and then when you didn't, I just... Another long breath out. Anyway, I need to talk. Because I realized... I mean, oh hell, could you, call me? If, you know... I didn't know. Not at all. I wasn't even sure who it was. Could that really be Rita? Another long sigh. I'm sorry if... And a very long pause, two full breaths, in deeply, out. In deeply, then blown out abruptly. Please call me, Dexter, just... A long pause, another sigh, then she hung up. Many times in my life, I have felt like I was missing something, some essential piece of the puzzle that everybody else carried around with them without thinking about it. I don't usually mind, since most of those times it turns out to be an astonishingly stupid piece of humania, like understanding the infield fly rule or not going all the way on the first date. But at other times, I feel like I am missing out on a great reservoir of warm wisdom, the lore of some sense I don't possess, that humans feel so deeply they don't need to talk about it and can't even put it into words. This was one of those times. I knew I was supposed to understand that Rita was actually saying something very specific, that her pauses and stutters added up to a great and marvelous thing that a human male would intuitively grasp. But I had not a single clue as to what it might be, nor how to figure it out. Should I count the breaths, time the pauses, and convert the numbers to Bible verses to arrive at the secret code? What was she trying to tell me? And why, for that matter, was she trying to tell me anything at all? As I understood things, when I had kissed Rita on that strange and stupid impulse, I had crossed a line we had both agreed to keep uncrossed. With that thing done, there was no undoing it, no going back. In its own way, the kiss had been an act of murder. At any rate, it was comforting to think so. I had killed our careful relationship by driving my tongue through its heart and pushing it off a cliff. Boom! A dead thing. I hadn't even thought about Rita since. She was gone, shoved out of my life by an incomprehensible whim. And now she was calling me and recording her breathing for my amusement. Why? Did she want to chastise me, call me names, rub my nose in my folly, force me to understand the immensity of my offense? The whole thing began to irritate me beyond measure. I paced around my apartment. Why should I have to think about Rita at all? I had more important concerns at the moment. Rita was merely my beard, a silly kid's costume I wore on weekends to hide the fact that I was the kind of person who did the things that this other interesting fellow was now doing and I wasn't. Was this jealousy? Of course I wasn't doing those things. I had just recently finished for the time being. I certainly wouldn't do it again any time soon. Too risky. I hadn't prepared anything. And yet... I walked back into the kitchen and flicked the Barbie head. Thack, thack, thack. I seemed to be feeling something here. Playfulness? Deep and abiding concern? Professional jealousy? I couldn't say, and Barbie wasn't talking. It was just too much. The obviously fake confession, the violation of my inner sanctum. And now Rita? A man can take only so much. Even a phony man like me. I began to feel unsettled, dizzy, confused, hyperactive and lethargic at the same time. I walked to the window and looked out. It was dark now, and far away over the water a light rose up in the sky, and at the sight of it a small and evil voice rose up to meet it from somewhere deep inside. "Moon!" A whisper in my ear. Not even a sound, just the slight sense of someone speaking your name, almost heard, somewhere nearby. Very near, perhaps getting closer. No words at all, just a dry rustle of not voice, a tone off tone, a thought on a breath. My face felt hot, and I could suddenly hear myself breathing. The voice came again. A soft sound dropped on the outer edge of my ear. I turned, even though I knew no one was there, and it was not my ear, but my dear friend inside, kicked into consciousness by who knows what and the moon. Such a fat, happy chatterbox moon. Oh, how much it had to say. And as much as I tried to tell it that the time was wrong, that this was much too soon, there were other things to do now, important things, the moon had words for all of it, and more. And so, even though I stood there for a quarter of an hour and argued, there was never really any question. I grew desperate, fighting it with all the tricks I had. And when that failed, I did something that shocked me to my very core. I called Rita. "Oh, Dexter," she said. I was afraid. Thank you for calling. I know," I said, although of course I did not know. "Could we... I don't know what you... Can I see you later and just... I would really like to talk to you." "Of course," I told her. And as we agreed to meet later at her place, I wondered what she might possibly have in mind. Violence? Tears of recrimination? Full-throated name-calling? I was on foreign turf here. I could be walking into anything. And after I hung up, the whole thing distracted me wonderfully for almost half an hour before the soft interior voice came sliding back into my brain with its quiet insistence that tonight really ought to be special. I felt myself pulled back to the window, and there it was again, the huge happy face in the sky, the chuckling moon. I pulled the curtain and turned away, circled my apartment from room to room, touching things, telling myself I was checking once more for whatever might be missing, knowing nothing was missing, and knowing why, too. And each time around the apartment, I circled closer and closer to the small desk in the living room where I kept my computer, knowing what I wanted to do and not wanting to do it, until finally, after 3/4 of an hour, the pull was too strong. I was too dizzy to stand and thought I would just slump into the chair since it was close at hand. And since I was there anyway, I turned on the computer, and once it was on... "But it's not done," I thought. "I'm not ready." And of course that didn't matter. Whether I was ready or not made no difference at all. It was ready.
Chapter 14.
I was almost certain he was the one. But only almost. And I had never been only almost certain before. I felt weak, intoxicated, half sick, with a combination of excitement and uncertainty and complete wrongness. But of course, the dark passenger was driving from the back seat now, and how I felt was not terribly important anymore, because he felt strong and cold and eager and ready. And I could feel him swelling inside me, surging up out of the Dexter dark corners of my lizard brain, a rising and swelling that could only end one way, and that being the case, it rather had to be with this one. I had found him several months ago, but after a little bit of observation, I'd decided that the priest was a sure thing, and this one could wait a little longer until I was positive. How wrong I had been. I now found he couldn't wait at all. He lived on a small street in Coconut Grove. A few blocks to one side of his crummy little house, the neighborhood was low-income black housing, barbecue joints, and crumbling churches. Half a mile in the other direction, the millionaires lived in overgrown modern houses and built coral walls to keep out people like him. But Jamie Jaworski was right in between, in a house he shared with a million palmetto bugs and the ugliest dog I had ever seen. It was still a house he shouldn't have been able to afford. Jaworski was a part-time janitor at Ponce de Leon Junior High, and as far as I could tell, that was his only source of income. He worked 3 days a week, which might be just enough to live on, but not much more. Of course, I was not interested in his finances. I was very interested in the fact that there had been a small but significant increase in runaway children from Ponce since Jaworski had begun to work there. All of them 12 to 13-year-old, light-haired girls. Light-haired. That was important. For some reason, it was the kind of detail that police often seemed to overlook, but always jumped out at someone like me. Perhaps it didn't seem politically correct. Dark-haired girls and dark-skinned girls should have an equal opportunity to be kidnapped, sexually abused, and then cut up in front of a camera, don't you think? Jaworski, too, often seemed to be the missing kid's last witness. The police had talked to him, held him overnight, questioned him, and had not been able to make anything stick to him. Of course, they have to meet certain petty legal requirements. Torture, for example, was frowned on lately, for the most part. And without some very forceful persuasion, Jamie Jaworski was never going to open up about his hobby. I know I wouldn't. But I knew he was doing it. He was helping those girls disappear into very quick and final movie careers. I was almost positive. I had not found any body parts and hadn't seen him do it, but everything fit. And on the internet, I did manage to locate some particularly inventive pictures of three of the missing girls. They did not look very happy in those pictures, although some of the things they were doing were supposed to bring joy, I have been told. I could not positively connect Jaworski with the pictures, but the mailbox address was South Miami, a few minutes from the school, and he was living above his means, and in any case I was being reminded with increasing force from the dark back seat that I was out of time, that this was not a case where certainty was terribly important. But the ugly dog worried me. Dogs were always a problem. They don't like me. And they quite often disapprove of what I do to their masters, especially since I don't share the good pieces. I had to find a way around the dog to Jaworski. Perhaps he would come out. If not, I had to find a way in. I drove past Jaworski's house 3 times, but nothing occurred to me. I needed some luck, and I needed it before the dark passenger made me do something hasty. And just as my dear friend began to whisper imprudent suggestions, I got my small piece of luck. Jaworski came out of his house and climbed into his battered red Toyota pickup as I drove past. I slowed down as much as I could, and in a moment he backed out and yanked his little truck toward Douglas Road. I turned around and followed. I had no idea how I was going to do this. I was not prepared. I had no safe room, no clean coveralls, nothing but a roll of duct tape and a fillet knife under my seat. I had to be unseen, unnoticed, and perfect, and I had no idea how. I hated to improvise, but I was not being offered a choice. Once again, I was lucky. Traffic was very light as Jaworski drove south to Old Cutler Road, and after a mile or so, he turned left toward the water. Another huge new development was going up to improve life for all of us by turning trees and animals into cement and old people from New Jersey. Jaworski drove slowly through the construction, past half a golf course with the flags in place but no grass on it, until he came almost to the water. The skeleton of a large, half-finished block of condos blotted out the moon. I dropped far back, turned out my headlights, and then inched close enough to see what my boy was up to. Jaworski had pulled in beside the block of condos to be and parked. He got out and stood between his little truck and a huge pile of sand. For a moment he just looked around, and I pulled onto the shoulder and turned off the engine. Jaworski stared at the condos and then down the road toward the water. He seemed satisfied and went into the building. I was quite certain that he was looking for a guard. I was too. I hoped he had done his homework. Most often in these huge Uber developments, one guard rides around from site to site in a golf cart. It saves money, and anyway, this is Miami. A certain amount of the overhead on any project is for material that is expected to disappear quietly. It looked to me like Jaworski planned to help the builder meet his quota. I got out of my car and slipped my fillet knife and duct tape into a cheap tote bag I'd brought along. I had already stuffed some rubberized gardening gloves and a few pictures inside it, nothing much, just trifles I'd downloaded from the internet. I shrugged the bag onto my shoulder and moved quietly through the night until I came to his grungy little truck. The bed was as empty as the cab, heaps of Burger King cups and wrappers, empty Camel packs on the floor, nothing that wasn't small and dirty like Jaworski himself. I looked up. Above the rim of the half condo, I could just see the glow of the moon. A night wind blew across my face, bringing with it all the enchanting odors of our tropical paradise, diesel oil, decaying vegetation, and cement. I inhaled it deeply and turned my thoughts back to Jaworski. He was somewhere inside the shell of the building. I didn't know how long I had, and a certain small voice was urging me to hurry. I left the truck and went into the building. As I stepped through the door, I heard him, or rather, I heard a strange, whirring, rattling sound that had to be him, or... I paused. The sound came from off to one side, and I whisper-footed over to it. A pipe ran up the wall, an electrical conduit. I placed a hand on the pipe and felt it vibrate, as if something inside was moving. A small light went on in my brain. Jaworski was pulling out the wire. Copper was very expensive, and there was a thriving black market for copper in any form. It was one more small way to supplement a meager janitorial salary, helping to cover the long, poverty-strewn stretches between young runaways. He could make several $100 for one load of copper. Now that I knew what he was up to, a vague outline of an idea began to take root in my brain. From the sound, he was above me somewhere. I could easily track him, shadow him until the time was right, and then pounce. But I was practically naked here, completely exposed and unready. I was used to doing these things a certain way. To step outside my own careful boundaries made me extremely uncomfortable. A small shudder crawled up my spine. Why was I doing this? The quick answer, of course, was that I wasn't doing it at all. My dear friend in the dark back seat was doing it. I was just along because I had the driver's license. But we had reached an understanding, he and I. We had achieved a careful, balanced existence, a way to live together through our Harry solution. And now he was rampaging outside Harry's careful, beautiful chalk lines. Why? Anger? Was the invasion of my home really such an outrage that it woke him to strike out in revenge? He didn't feel angry to me. As always, he seemed cool, quietly amused, eager for his prey. And I didn't feel angry either. I felt half-drunk, high as a kite, teetering on the knife edge of euphoria, wobbling through a series of inner ripples that felt curiously like I have always thought emotions must feel. And the giddiness of it had driven me to this dangerous, unclean, unplanned place to do something on the spur of the moment that always before I had planned carefully. And even knowing all this, I badly wanted to do it, had to do it. Very well, then. But I didn't have to do it undressed. I looked around. A large pile of sheetrock squatted at the far end of the room, bound with shrink wrap. A moment's work, and I had cut myself an apron and a strange, transparent mask from the shrink wrap, nose, mouth, and eyes sliced away so I could breathe, talk, and see. I pulled it tight, feeling it mash my features into something unrecognizable. I twisted the ends behind my head and tied a clumsy knot in the plastic. Perfect anonymity. It might seem silly, but I was used to hunting with a mask. And aside from a neurotic compulsion to make everything right, it was simply one less thing to think about. It made me relax a little, so it was a good idea. I took the gloves from the tote bag and slipped them on. I was ready now. I found Jaworski on the third floor. A pile of electrical wire pooled at his feet. I stood in the shadows of the stairwell and watched as he pulled out wire. I ducked back into the stairwell and opened my tote bag. Using my duct tape, I hung up the pictures I had brought along. Sweet little photos of the runaway girls, and a variety of endearing and very explicit poses. I taped them to the concrete walls where Jaworski would see them as he stepped through the door onto the stairs. I looked back in at Jaworski. He pulled out another 20 yards of wire. It stuck on something and would pull no more. Jaworski yanked twice, then pulled a pair of heavy cutters from his back pocket and snipped the wire. He picked up the wire lying at his feet and wound it into a tight coil on his forearm. Then he walked toward the stairs. Toward me. I shrank back into the stairwell and waited. Jaworski wasn't trying to be quiet. He was not expecting any interruption, and he certainly wasn't expecting me. I listened to his footsteps and the small rattle of the wire coil dragging behind him. Closer. He came through the door and a step passed without seeing me, and then he saw the pictures. "Oof," he said, as though he had been hit hard in the stomach. He stared, slack-jawed, unable to move, and then I was behind him with my knife at his throat. "Don't move and don't make a sound," we said. "Hey, look it," he said. I turned my wrist slightly and pushed the knife point into his skin under the chin. He hissed as a distressing, awful little spurt of blood squirted out. "So unnecessary. Why can't people ever listen?" "I said, don't make a sound," we told him, and now he was quiet. And then, the only sound was the ratcheting of the duct tape, Jaworski's breathing, and the quiet chuckle from the dark passenger. I taped over his mouth, twisted a length of the janitor's precious copper wire around his wrists, and dragged him over to another stack of shrink-wrapped sheetrock. In just a few moments, I had him trussed up and secured to the makeshift table. "Let's talk," we said in the dark passenger's gentle, cold voice. He didn't know if he was allowed to speak, and the duct tape would have made it difficult in any case, so he stayed silent. "Let's talk about runaways," we said, ripping the duct tape from his mouth.
"Yow! Well, what do you mean?" he said.
But he was not very convincing. "I think you know what I mean," we told him.
No,
he said. Yes, we said. Probably one word too clever. My timing was off. The whole evening was off. But he got brave. He looked up at me in my shiny face.
"What are you, a cop or something?" he asked.
"No," we said, and sliced off his left ear. It was closest. The knife was sharp, and for a moment he couldn't believe it was happening to him, permanent and forever no left ear. So I dropped the ear on his chest to let him believe. His eyes got huge and he filled his lungs to scream, but I stuffed a wad of plastic wrap in his mouth just before he did. "None of that," we said. "Worse things can happen." And they would. Oh, definitely. But he didn't need to know that yet. "The runaways?" we asked, gently, coldly, and waited for just a moment, watching his eyes to make sure he wouldn't scream, then removed the gag.
"Jesus," he said hoarsely, "my ear!"
"You have another just as good," we said. "Tell us about the girls in those pictures."
"Us? What do you mean, us? Jesus, that hurts," he whimpered.
"Some people just don't get it." I put the plastic stuff back in his mouth and went to work. I almost got carried away, easy to do under the circumstances. My heart was racing like mad, and I had to fight hard to keep my hand from shaking. But I went to work, exploring, looking for something that was always just beyond my fingertips. Exciting, and terribly frustrating. The pressure was rising inside me, climbing up into my ears and screaming for release. But no release came, just the growing pressure, and the sense that something wonderful was just beyond my senses, waiting for me to find it and dive in. But I did not find it, and none of my old standards gave me any joy at all. What to do? In my confusion, I opened up a vein, and a horrible puddle of blood formed on the plastic wrap alongside the janitor. I stopped for a moment, looking for an answer, finding nothing. I looked away out the shell of the window. I stared, forgetting to breathe. The moon was visible over the water. For some reason I could not explain that seemed so right, so necessary, that for a moment I just looked out across the water, watching it shimmer so very perfect. I swayed and bumped against my makeshift table and came back to myself. But the moon. Or was it the water? So close. I was so close to something I could almost smell. But what? A shiver ran through me, and that was right, too. So right, it set off a whole chain of shivers until my teeth chattered. But why? What did it mean? Something was there, something important. An overwhelming purity and clarity, riding the moon in the water just beyond the tip of my fillet knife, and I couldn't catch it. I looked back at the janitor. He made me so angry, the way he was lying there, covered with improvised marks and unnecessary blood. But it was hard to stay angry, with the beautiful Florida moon pounding at me, the tropical breeze blowing, the wonderful night sounds of flexing duct tape and panic breathing. I almost had to laugh. Some people choose to die for some very unusual things, but this horrid little bug, dying for copper wire. And the look on his face, so hurt and confused and desperate. It would have been funny if I hadn't felt so frustrated. And he really did deserve a better effort from me. After all, it wasn't his fault I was off my usual form. He wasn't even vile enough to be at the top of my to-do list. He was just a repulsive little slug who killed children for money and kicks, and only four or five of them, as far as I knew. I almost felt sorry for him. He truly wasn't ready for the major leagues. Ah, well. Back to work. I stepped back to Jaworski's side. He was not thrashing as much now, but he was still far too lively for my usual methods. Of course, I did not have all my highly professional toys tonight, and the going must have been a little rough for Jaworski, but like a real trooper, he had not complained. I felt a surge of affection and slowed down my slapdash approach, spending some quality time on his hands. He responded with real enthusiasm, and I drifted away lost in happy research. Eventually, it was his muffled screams and wild thrashing that called me back to myself, and I remembered I had not even made sure of his guilt. I waited for him to calm down, then removed the plastic from his mouth. "The runaways," we asked.
"Oh, Jesus! Oh, God! Oh, Jesus!" he said weakly.
"I don't think so," we said. "I think we may have left them behind."
"Please," he said. "Oh, please."
"Tell me about the runaways," we said.
"Okay,"
he breathed. "You took those girls?"
"Yes."
"How many?"
He just breathed for a moment. His eyes were closed, and I thought I might have lost him a little early. He finally opened his eyes and looked at me. "Five," he said at last. "Five little beauties. I'm not sorry."
"Of course you're not," we said.
I placed a hand on his arm. It was a beautiful moment.
"And now, I'm not sorry either."
I stuffed the plastic into his mouth and went back to work, but I had really only just started to recapture my rhythm when I heard the guard arrive downstairs.
Chapter 15. It was the static of his radio that gave him away. I was deeply involved in something I'd never tried before when I heard it. I was working on the torso with the knife point, and could feel the first real tinglings of response down my spine and through my legs, and I didn't want to stop. But a radio. This was worse news than a mere guard arriving. If he called for backup, or to have the road blocked. It was just possible that I might find a few of the things I had been doing a little difficult to explain. I looked down at Jaworski. He was nearly done now, and yet I was not happy with how things had gone. Far too much mess, and I had not really found what I was looking for. There had been a few moments where I felt on the brink of some wonderful thing, some amazing revelation to do with... what? The water flowing by outside the window? But it had not happened, whatever it had been. Now I was left with an unfinished, unclean, untidy, unsatisfying child rapist and a security guard on his way to join us. I hate to rush the conclusion. It's such an important moment, and a real relief for both of us, the dark passenger and I. But what choice did I have? For a long moment, far too long, really, and I'm quite ashamed, I thought about killing the guard and going on. It would be easy, and I could continue to explore with a fresh start. But no, of course not. It wouldn't do. The guard was innocent as anyone can be and still live in Miami. He'd probably done nothing worse than shoot at other drivers on the Palmetto Expressway a few times. Practically Snow White. No, I had to make a hasty retreat, and that was all there was to it. And if I had to leave the janitor not quite finished and me not quite satisfied, well, better luck next time. I stared down at the grubby little insect and felt myself fill with loathing. The thing was drooling snot and blood all together, the ugly wet slop burbling across his face. A trickle of awful red came from his mouth. In a quick fit of pique, I slashed across Jaworski's throat. I immediately regretted my rashness. A fountain of horrible blood came out, and the sight made it all seem even more regrettable, a messy mistake. Feeling unclean and unsatisfied, I sprinted for the stairwell. A cold and petulant grumbling from my dark passenger followed me. I turned out onto the second floor and slid sideways over to a glassless window. Below me I could see the guard's golf cart parked, pointing in the direction of old Cutler, meaning, I hoped, that he had come from the other direction and had not seen my car. Standing beside the cart, a fat, olive-skinned young man with black hair and a wispy black mustache was looking up at the building, luckily looking at the other end at the moment. What had he heard? Was he merely on his regular route? I had to hope so. If he had actually heard something, if he stood outside and called for help, I was probably going to be caught. And as clever and glib-tongued as I was, I did not think I was good enough to talk my way out of this. The young guard touched a thumb to his mustache and stroked it as if to encourage fuller growth. He frowned, swept his gaze along the front of the building. I ducked back. When I peeked out again a moment later, I could just see the top of his head. He was coming in. I waited until I heard his feet in the stairwell. Then I was out the window, halfway between the first and second floors, hanging by my fingertips from the coarse cement at the window sill, then dropping. I hit badly, one ankle twisting on a rock, one knuckle skinned. But in my very best rapid limp, I hurried into the shadows and scurried for my car. My heart was pounding when I finally slid into the driver's seat. I looked back and saw no sign of the guard. I started the engine, and with the lights still off, I drove as quickly and quietly as I could out onto old Cutler Road, heading toward South Miami and taking the long way home along Dixie Highway. My pulse still pounded in my ears. What a stupid risk to take. I had never before done anything so impulsive, never before done anything at all without careful planning. That was the Harry way. Be careful, be safe, be prepared. The dark scouts. And instead, this. I could have been caught. I could have been seen. Stupid. Stupid. If I had not heard the young security guard in time, I might have had to kill him. Kill an innocent man with violence. I was quite sure Harry would disapprove. And it was so messy and unpleasant, too. Of course, I was still not safe. The guard might easily have written down my license number if he had passed my car in his little golf cart. I had taken brainless, terrible risks, gone against all my careful procedures, gambled my entire carefully built life. And for what? A thrill kill? Shame on me. And deep in the shaded corner of my mind, the echo came, "Oh, yes, shame," and the familiar chuckle. I took a deep breath and looked at my hand on the steering wheel. But it had been thrilling, hadn't it? It had been wildly exciting, full of life and new sensations and profound frustration. It had been something entirely new and interesting. And the odd sensation that it was all going somewhere, an important place that was new and yet familiar. I would really have to explore that a little better next time. Not that there was going to be a next time, of course. I would certainly never again do anything so foolish and impulsive. Never. But to have done it once, kind of fun. Never mind. I would go home and take an exceptionally long shower, and by the time I was done, time. It came into my mind unwanted and unasked. I had agreed to meet with Rita at, right about now, according to my dashboard clock. And for what dark purpose? I couldn't know what went on in the human female mind. Why did I even have to think about for what at a time like this, when all my nerve endings were standing up and yodeling with frustration? I did not care what Rita wanted to yell at me about. It would not really bother me, whatever sharp observations she had to make on my character defects. But it was irritating to be forced to spend time listening when I had other far more important things to think about. Most particularly, I wanted to wonder what I should have done that I had not done with dear departed Jaworski. Up to the cruelly interrupted and unfinished climax, so many new things had happened that needed my very best mental efforts. I needed to reflect, to consider, and to understand where it had all been leading me. And how did it relate to that other artist out there, shadowing me and challenging me with his work? With all this to think about, why did I need Rita right now? But of course I would go. And of course it would actually serve some humble purpose if I should need an alibi for my adventure with the little janitor. Why, detective? How could you possibly think that I... Besides, I was having a fight with my girlfriend at the time. Ex-girlfriend, actually. Because there was absolutely no doubt in my mind that Rita merely wanted to... What was the word we were all using lately? Vent. Yes, Rita wanted me to come over so she could vent on me. I had certain major character flaws that she needed to point out with an accompanying burst of emotion, and my presence was necessary. Since this was the case, I took an extra minute to clean up. I circled back toward Coconut Grove and parked on the far side of the bridge over the waterway. A good deep channel ran underneath. I rolled a couple of large coral rocks out of the trees at the edge of the waterway, stuffed them into my tote bag, which was loaded with the plastic gloves and knife, and flung the thing into the center of the channel. I stopped once more at a small dark park almost to Rita's house and washed off carefully. I had to be neat and presentable. Getting yelled at by a furious woman should be treated as a semi-formal occasion. But imagine my surprise. When I rang her doorbell a few minutes later, she did not fling wide the door and begin to hurl furniture and abuse at me. In fact, she opened the door very slowly and carefully, half hiding behind it, as if badly frightened of what might be waiting for her on the other side. And considering that it was me waiting, this showed rare common sense. "Dexter?" she said softly, shyly, sounding like she wasn't sure whether she wanted me to answer yes or no. "I didn't think you were coming." "And yet here I am," I said helpfully. She didn't answer for a much longer time than seemed right. Finally, she nudged the door slightly more open and said, "Would you come in, please?" And if her uncertain, limping tone of voice, unlike any I had ever heard her use before, was a surprise. Imagine how astonished I was by her costume. I believe the thing was called a peignoir, or possibly it was a negligee, since it certainly was negligible as far as the amount of fabric used in its construction was concerned. Whatever the correct name, she was certainly wearing it. And as bizarre as the idea was, I believe the costume was aimed at me.
"Please?" she repeated.
It was all a little much. I mean, really, what was I supposed to do here? I was bubbling over with unsatisfied experimentation on the janitor. There were still unhappy murmurings filtering through from the back seat, and a quick check of the situation at large revealed that I was being whipsawed between Dear Deb and the dark artist, and now I was expected to do some sort of human thing here, like, well, what, after all? She surely couldn't want... I mean, wasn't she mad at me? What was going on here? And why was it going on with me?
"I sent the kids next door," Rita said. She bumped the door with her hip.
I went in. I can think of a great many ways to describe what happened next, but none of them seem adequate. She went to the couch. I followed. She sat down. So did I. She looked uncomfortable and squeezed her left hand with her right. She seemed to be waiting for something, and since I was not quite sure what, I found myself thinking about my unfinished work with Jaworski. If only I'd had a little more time. The things I might have done. And as I thought of some of those things, I became aware that Rita had quietly started to cry. I stared at her for a moment, trying to suppress the images of a flayed and bloodless janitor. For the life of me, I could not understand why she was crying. But since I had practiced long and hard at imitating human beings, I knew that I was supposed to comfort her. I leaned forward and put an arm across her shoulder. "Rita," I said, "there, there." Not really a line worthy of me, but it was well thought of by many experts. And it was effective. Rita lunged forward and leaned her face into my chest. I tightened my arm around her, which brought my hand back into view. Less than an hour ago, that same hand had been holding a fillet knife over the little janitor. The thought made me dizzy. And really, I don't know how it happened, but it did. One moment I was patting her and saying, "There, there," and staring at the cords in my hand, feeling the sense memory pulse through the fingers, the surge of power and brightness as the knife explored Jaworski's abdomen. And the next moment, I believe Rita looked up at me. I am also reasonably certain that I looked back. And yet somehow it was not Rita I saw, but a neat stack of cool and bloodless limbs. And it was not Rita's hands I felt on my belt buckle, but the rising unsatisfied chorus from the dark passenger. And some little time later... Well, it's still somewhat unthinkable. I mean, right there on the couch. How on earth did that happen? By the time I climbed into my little bed, I was thoroughly whipped. I don't ordinarily require a great deal of sleep, but I felt as though tonight I might need a nice solid 36 hours. The ups and downs of the evening, the strain of so much new experience, it had all been draining. More draining for Jaworski, of course, the nasty, wet little thing. But I had used all my adrenaline for the month in this one impetuous evening. I could not even begin to think what any of it meant, from the strange impulse to fly out into the night so madly and rashly, all the way through to the unthinkable things that had happened with Rita. I had left her asleep and apparently much happier, but poor dark deranged Dexter was without a clue once again, and when my head hit the pillow, I fell asleep almost instantly. And there I was out over the city like a boneless bird, flowing and swift, and the cold air moved around me and drew me on, pulled me down to where the moonlight rippled on the water, and I slash into the tight, cold killing room where the little janitor looks up at me and laughs, spread-eagled under the knife and laughing. And the effort of it contorts his face, changes it, and now he is not Jaworski anymore, but a woman, and the man holding the knife looks up to where I float above the whirling red viscera, and as the face comes up, I can hear Harry outside the door. and I turn just before I can see who it is on the table, but I woke up. The pain in my head would split a cantaloupe. I felt like I had hardly closed my eyes, but the bedside clock said it was 5:14. Another dream. Another long-distance call on my phantom party line. No wonder I had steadfastly refused to have dreams for most of my life. So stupid. Such pointless, obvious symbols. Totally uncontrollable anxiety soup. Hateful, blatant nonsense. And now I couldn't get back to sleep, thinking of the infantile images. If I had to dream, why couldn't it be more like me, interesting and different? I sat up and rubbed my throbbing temples. Terrible, tedious unconsciousness dripped away like a draining sinus, and I sat on the edge of the bed in bleary befuddlement. What was happening to me? And why couldn't it happen to someone else? This dream had felt different, and I wasn't sure what that difference was or what it meant. The last time I had been absolutely certain that another murder was about to happen and even knew where, but this time... I sighed and padded into the kitchen for a drink of water. Barbie's head went thack, thack, as I opened the refrigerator. I stood and watched, sipping a large glass of cold water. The bright blue eyes stared back at me, unblinking. Why had I had a dream? Was it just the strain of last evening's adventures playing back from my battered subconscious? I had never felt strain before. Actually, it had always been a release of strain. Of course I had never come so close to disaster before either, but why dream about it? Some of the images were too painfully obvious. Jaworski and Harry and the unseen face of the man with the knife. Really now, why bother me with stuff from freshman psychology? Why bother me with a dream at all? I didn't need it. I needed rest. And instead, here I was in the kitchen playing with a Barbie doll. I flipped the head again. Thack, thack. For that matter, what was Barbie all about? And how was I going to figure this out in time to rescue Deborah's career? How could I get around Lagerta when the poor thing was so taken with me? And by all that was holy, if anything actually was, why had Rita needed to do that to me? It seemed suddenly like a twisted soap opera, and it was far too much. I found some aspirin and leaned against the kitchen counter as I ate three of them. I didn't much care for the taste. I had never liked medicine of any kind, except in a utilitarian way, especially since Harry had died. Chapter 16. Harry did not die quickly, and he did not die easily. He took his own terrible long time, the first and last selfish thing he had ever done in his life. Harry died for a year and a half, in little stages, slipping for a few weeks, fighting back to almost full strength again, keeping us all dizzy with trying to guess. Would he go now, this time, or had he beaten it altogether? We never knew, but because it was Harry, it seemed foolish for us to give up. Harry would do what was right, no matter how hard. But what did that mean in dying? Was it right to fight and hang on and make the rest of us suffer through an endless death, when death was coming, no matter what Harry did? Or was it right to slip away gracefully and without fuss? At 19, I certainly didn't know the answer, although I already knew more about death than most of the other pimple-ridden pudding heads in my sophomore class at the University of Miami. And one fine autumn afternoon after a chemistry class, as I walked across the campus toward the student union, Deborah appeared beside me. "Deborah," I called to her, sounding very collegiate, I thought. "Come have a Coke." Harry had told me to hang out at the union and have Cokes. He'd said it would help me pass for human and learn how other humans behaved. And of course he was right. In spite of the damage to my teeth, I was learning a great deal about the unpleasant species. Deborah, at 17, already far too serious, shook her head. "It's Dad," she said. And very shortly we were driving across town to the hospice where they had taken Harry. Hospice was not good news. That meant the doctors were saying that Harry was ready to die, and suggesting that he cooperate. Harry did not look good when we got there. He looked so green and still against the sheets that I thought we were too late. He was spindly and gaunt from his long fight, looking for all the world as though something inside him was eating its way out. The respirator beside him hissed, a Darth Vader sound from a living grave. Harry was alive, strictly speaking.
"Dad," Deborah said, taking his hand, "I brought Dexter."
Harry opened his eyes, and his head rolled toward us, almost as if some invisible hand had pushed it from the far side of the pillow. But they were not Harry's eyes. They were murky blue pits, dull and empty, uninhabited. Harry's body might be alive, but he was not home. "It isn't good," the nurse told us. "We're just trying to make him comfortable now." And she busied herself with a large hypodermic needle from a tray, filling it and holding it up to squirt out the air bubble.
"Wait!"
It was so faint that I thought at first it might be the respirator. I looked around the room, and my eyes finally fell on what was left of Harry. Behind the dull emptiness of his eyes, a small spark was shining.
"Wait,"
he said again, nodding toward the nurse. She either didn't hear him or had decided to ignore him. She stepped to his side and gently lifted his stick arm. She began to swab it with a cotton ball.
"No,"
Harry gasped gently, almost inaudibly. I looked at Deborah. She seemed to be standing at attention in a perfect posture of formal uncertainty. I looked back at Harry, his eyes locked onto mine.
"No,"
he said, and there was something very close to horror in his eyes now.
"No shot."
I stepped forward and put a restraining hand on the nurse, just before she plunged the needle into Harry's vein. "Wait," I said. She looked up at me, and for the tiniest fraction of a second there was something in her eyes. I almost fell backward in surprise. It was a cold rage, an inhuman, lizard brain sense of "I want," a belief that the world was her very own game preserve. Just that one flash, but I was sure. She wanted to ram the needle into my eye for interrupting her. She wanted to shove it into my